the glorification of Zelensky is somehow the other side of the demonization of Vladimir Putin.
But as long as we sustain the military assistance to Ukraine, Zelensky will spit in our face. We now admit that 50% of all the cash that we've delivered, and probably 50% of most of the aid in terms of equipment, has all been pilfered and sold on the black market.
Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde. Ich begrüße Sie zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, aufgezeichnet am Dienstag, dem 25. März 2025. Und jetzt werde ich ins Englische wechseln, um unseren Gast von heute zu begrüßen. Er ist Ihnen wohl bekannt und ich freue mich sehr, dass er jetzt in der Leitung ist. In unserem Programm Colonel McGregor, Douglas McGregor, now from the United States, here online. It's a pleasure and privilege to have you here. Dear Colonel, to start our conversation with some small talk, how are you?
Good to see you. I'm well, thanks.
Everything okay? I mean,
nobody's taken any shots at me lately, so I'm in pretty good shape.
Okay, very good, very good. I wanted to start with a personal question. I mean, you are a praised combat commander of the armed forces of the United States in America. You have published several books. You have been in the first Iraq war. What is actually the most important thing you have learned in battle?
Well, of course, learning something in combat at close range is different from learning from war in a broader sense. I think the most important thing that you learn is that everything takes longer than you think it will. In other words, everything is more difficult than you anticipated. Things never work out as you thought they would, and fighting takes much longer than you thought it would take. I think that's the most important lesson, because there's this unfortunate habit, particularly in the United States, where we have what I would call a microwave culture. You know, you open the microwave oven, you put something in, instantaneously it's heated, it comes out. And Americans expect everything to happen instantaneously. And of course, that's simply not the case in war. And we've seen that in Ukraine. We've seen that in the Middle East repeatedly. And that's my greatest concern right now. When people talk about war, they need to understand that it's not something that happens quickly and ends quickly.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, what makes a good officer at the end? What's the essence of good military leadership?
Well, we haven't had much of it lately. So I think it's an abstract concept. I think a sense of accountability or responsibility for the people you command and lead into action, and at the same time a responsibility for your professional competence, that you arrive on the scene as competent as you can be, knowing as much as possible. People don't take their profession seriously enough, because most of the time that you serve in the military is not at war. And there's a tendency to become complacent. And you don't read and you don't study not only the past, but also modern technology and what's changing. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to do all of those things. And then you have to also raise the right issues for the political leaders that you serve, because it is always someone in a position of political power who is urging action. And when they urge action, you have a responsibility to stand up and say, if you want us to do this, whatever it is, you want us to move from point A to point B and attack someone, this is what it will entail. Mm-hmm. Because again, there is a failure to understand that something that from a distance looks simple, but when you study it more closely, it's much more complex. Mm-hmm. And the possibilities are endless in terms of what can go wrong. And that's not a popular position to take if you are a senior officer. Politicians like yes men, who are four stars, that don't raise difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. You know, the most famous example I can think of course, is Hitler was upset with General Marx, mm-hmm. who was the first man to draft Operation Barbarossa as a plan, because he said once you reach the Dnieper River, where Kiev is located, that line effectively, you have to stop for 6 months. You have to build airports. You have to build railways. You have to stockpile logistics. And, of course, Hitler was furious. He said, well, that's impossible. We can't just move that far and stop. And, of course, Marx said, well, you don't have any choice because you can't move any further lest you overextend yourself and become vulnerable. So he told Halder, who was the chief of the general staff, I don't like him. Get him out of here. And he was replaced by someone named Paulus. And Paulus was suddenly very successful because he changed all of the assumptions. Mm-hmm. Oh, we don't have to stop after we reach the river line. We don't need a six-month break. We can do this much more quickly. He's overestimating the difficulties. The rest is history.
It ended in Stalingrad for Paulus.
Yeah, but my point is that I've seen that happen with the U.S. military over and over and over again. You know, in 2003, there was no plan to occupy because everyone understood occupation is a disaster. Don't do it. You know, keep the state intact. Bring the army back on active duty. Let the people govern themselves. If you don't do that, then you will have a massive unrest and you will become, as Genghis Khan said, occupations turn soldiers into jailers. So they never occupied, the Mongols. They would implement their plan, defeat their enemy, put another group of people in charge, and move on. We haven't learned those lessons very well. So when you start talking about bombing someone somewhere, you say, well, we bomb and then we fly away. Well, that may seem to be the case, but what if you bomb and someone decides to come back and bomb you? You know, the chief of the RAF during World War II said the Germans were very enthusiastic about bombing other people until they figured out that they too could be bombed. And I think that's our problem in the United States. We assume that we are invulnerable, invincible, immune, that mm-hmm. nothing will reach us and that we can bomb other people without consequences. Those days are over. The consequences are profound and they will hurt us as well.
Let me add one further personal question here. I mean, you, as I said, you've been in combat. You're confronted there with existential situations. I mean, you have to kill other people. You might be killed yourself. This is something very few people today have really experienced, especially in Middle Europe, in Switzerland. We just read about it. We see it on television. How did that change you as a human being? How did that shape your perception, your view of life, of everything?
Well, this may sound a little strange, but my experience was that the most difficult thing for me was to stop the soldiers I was leading from killing the enemy. There was no difficulty with killing the enemy. They were eager to do it. And when they discovered that they could do it effectively, they were very enthusiastic about it. And it went on to the point where I had to finally say, we're not allowed to advance any further. And I said, we're stopped. We've got to give the people that are still out there a chance to surrender. Mm-hmm. And many of my officers, one or two especially, were very angry. Their attitude was, wait a minute, we're killing them. We should kill them all. And I said, we didn't come here to kill everyone. We came here to fight and win. We've done that. We need to stop, see who is still alive, and give these people a chance to surrender. So they did. You know, we did stop. And we were surprised, since it had been such a ferocious assault and involved so much killing, with so many rounds fired and so many, you know, we destroyed dozens and dozens and dozens of tanks and armored fighting vehicles, killed a lot of people who were just trying to survive on the battlefield. We were surprised that 300 or 400 people emerged from the wreckage and came forward to surrender. So the thing that people, I think, don't understand is that they always think of, well, if I go to war, I'm going to be sickened by it. I'm going to feel badly about it. In reality, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. We discovered that we were very competent, very lethal, and the soldiers became very comfortable killing the enemy. Mm-hmm. So the biggest challenge was to stop the killing. And I think that's true right now. We don't know really when to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem the United States has. It doesn't seem to know what its limits are. And if you don't know when to stop, you risk a situation in which the enemy comes back and annihilates you.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point.
Yeah. If we look at the current situation of the war in Ukraine, I see one great silver lining, which is at long last, we have an American administration, we have an American president who puts peace first, who says we have to stop this war, who seems dedicated to stop this war. He's absurdly criticized, I think, in the European Union. We talk about that later. But what do you make of these peace plans, peace progress, of all these talks of American President Donald Trump at the moment with the Russian side? We have even heard that there have been more conversations between Putin and Trump than was publicly known. Are you as optimistic as I am, or do you see some clouds there at this brighter horizon?
Well, my experience with President Trump is that if he follows his instincts, he'll be fine. His instinct has always told him that this war in Ukraine was a mistake, and he's correct. Now, the next question is, if it's a mistake, how do you go about ending it? And you will recall that before he was elected, he said, if I'm elected, I can end this in 24 hours.
Yeah.
Again, this is the microwave culture speaking. You know, open the door, put it in, close it, hit the button, it's heated up. That was a mistake to say such a thing. There was a failure to understand the complexities involved, a failure to understand the interests involved. Clearly, he and President Putin share the same interest. They want to end the killing. They want to end the war. There's no question about that. The problem is, how do you go about it? And I'm afraid that too many people around President Trump are saying, well, you can't do this or you can't do that because it has to be a win for you, boss. You know, whatever we do, it has to be a win. You can't be seen as essentially giving in to the Russians or mm-hmm. recognizing their position. Of course, that's nonsense. We have had a terrible role in this war. We are mightily responsible for the deaths of at least 1.2 million Ukrainian soldiers and for certainly 100,000 Russian soldiers. We are responsible. I don't think that's sunk in with him. And if that's true, and I think it is, the first thing that you do is you make the decision to stop feeding the fire. You stop feeding the fire by ending any more aid in the form of military equipment or munitions and no more cash, because the corrupt machinery that runs the army and the state lives on the cash that we deliver to them.
Hmm.
And I have urged him repeatedly, stop the aid, end it, and then get us out. In other words, we Americans are no longer going to back this. We're not participating in it. We are leaving, and pull all of the Americans in and out of uniform out of Ukraine. And I think he would normally do that, but he's got people around him saying, oh, no, that'll look like a loss. Oh, no, that'll look like you've surrendered, which is nonsense.
Yeah.
It's simply the recognition that this has to happen to end the war. And the other good thing that he recognizes is the criticality of normalizing our relations with Moscow. But every time he tries to do it, he's got people around him saying, oh, you can't lift the sanctions. Oh, you can't do that. You know, that we need that pressure. That's a bargaining chip. Wait a minute. How did we get into this mess? Mm-hmm. You know, President Trump has always understood this is not a good thing and we shouldn't be in it. And he is beguiled by people telling him, you need bargaining chips, you need leverage, you need this, you need that. Number one point is, we in the United States have never had any vital strategic interest in Ukraine ever. That's number one. Number two, especially in eastern Ukraine, which is east of the Dnieper River, that historically is Russian terrain. That is an area of Russian influence, culture, power, and strategic interest. Recognizing that is not a sign that you have somehow or another capitulated. That's a recognition of a fact, of reality. He's not very good at standing his ground when he's dealing with people around him and say, no. You know, we need to hold off on that. We need to keep those sanctions in place. We need to keep that aid going until we get an agreement. Doesn't understand that the Russians are not thinking in those terms. The Russians regard what's happening there as an existential question for them. This is an existential fight. If they cannot defeat this enemy once and for all and put it to bed, then they're committed to marching further west. They don't want to. They would like to end this war tomorrow morning. But they're seeing an enemy in Kiev that is like a cancerous tumor. You know, you've got to remove it. If you don't remove it, it will grow back again and again. They don't want to refight this war in 5 or 10 years. There is no willingness. Well, I wouldn't say willingness. There's simply no understanding in Washington of what people in Moscow think. And there needs to also be an understanding that the most important thing right now for us as Americans, and I would argue for Europeans, is not what people in Kiev think. It's what people in Moscow think. We need good relations with Russia, period. And whatever happens in Ukraine should be subordinate to that interest. That's not well understood. That needs to be understood.
I mean, the interesting thing for me with President Trump, and especially also with you, because you have been one of the very few voices, prominent voices, who spoke out against this war from the beginning. You have stayed your point, you have stayed on your line, and you've been vindicated by events over and over. Now, Donald Trump seems to have a different approach than the conservative or Republican establishment in the United States, which seems to me rather anti-Russian. We saw it in his first presidency when he said, well, I respect, he said that in an interview, Trump, I respect President Putin. He was attacked at the time by Bill O'Reilly, still at Fox News. And then the Congress forced upon Trump, I had the impression, a strong support for Ukraine, and also you just felt that the American establishment was strongly against Russia. What do you think? Is Trump strong enough against these forces, let's call them Cold War forces, in the United States establishment to push through his peacemaking agenda?
I think he's strong enough. The question is whether or not he will do it. That's the whole issue here.
Why should he not do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's got, again, if you have to look at the people that have been appointed to key positions in his cabinet. You have to look at the people that he's listening to. And they are not necessarily telling him what I just said. They are telling him something else. And there's this notion that he has to have this win, his image, his position inside the country. What President Trump needs to understand is no one in the United States is interested in a war in Ukraine, period. It doesn't matter what people in Washington want. You know, the elite, if you will, the ruling political class in this country is completely removed from reality inside the United States. What the average American wants, what the average American needs, is something they could care less about. Now, the reason people voted for Donald Trump was because they heard a man who said things that resonated with them. In other words, the broader public. This is someone who understands what Americans want, understands what they need, and is going to try and deliver. Well, you're not going to deliver until you shut the door on all of these voices on the Hill, inside the Beltway, that have nothing to do with American national interest and are all about themselves. This giant laundering machine for money that washes through Washington, D.C., that turns congressmen into millionaires, turns senators into multimillionaires or billionaires. That is a disaster for the American people. He's not part of that. Remember, he came in as someone who did not show up to steal money. He had money. He wasn't interested in that. Everybody loved him for that, that he came in to do what he thought was in the interest of the average American. I still think he wants to do it. But he's dealing with a multiplicity of voices. And how does he handle that? It's very tough to say, listen, I've heard you, I've listened to your counsel, and I appreciate your interest, but this is what is in the interest of the United States. And we have no interest in perpetuating conflict with Russia in Ukraine or anywhere else. We, in fact, want to normalize relations with Russia. That's what I'm going to do. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I mean,
that's what he has to do, but he hasn't really done that.
Yeah. What do you make of these attempts now in the European Union to really wrap up, to rearm, to wrap up the armed forces, to bring back the whole defense infrastructure? I mean, this has been neglected for many, many years. The Europeans have just left the burden to the United States, whereas they have expanded their welfare states. Now, at least they see the urgency of military forces. And now they're pushing a lot of money, a lot of debt into rearmament. What do you think about this?
Well, first of all, whatever they do, it will be 10 years before they see any significant change. I mean, that's your point, is it not, Roger? That it's just been ignored for so long that, you know, you can't have the microwave experience with military power in Europe. It's going to take many, many years to rebuild. The Europeans should have a viable military capability for defense primarily. But the point is that, is Russia really the reason for this? Because Putin gave what I thought was a very reasonable speech a few weeks ago, and he spoke to the Europeans and he said, we're not your enemy. We're not interested in fighting you. You know, what is the Russian state want to do? Are the Russians going to send hundreds of thousands of troops to Paris so that they can all have lattes in the cafes? I mean, what the hell's the point? There is no point to a war in Europe. I think that's President Putin's argument. He's correct. That should be our argument. I think the European ruling class needs to go away. These people, call them globalists, whatever you want to call them, but they're not representing the interests of the European electorates. And this business of building up this boogeyman in Moscow that doesn't really exist is the wrong way to go about it. I mean, the danger, of course, as you know, Roger, is if you do this repeatedly, eventually it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and you get the very thing you don't want. I think the Germans in particular should understand that. Why they would feel threatened at this point is beyond my imagination. All the problems that we have in the West, we in the United States, you in Europe, are inside our borders. They're not outside the borders.
I mean, you had the same problem in the United States under the Biden presidency. They used this bogeyman, as you said, Putin, as this demon, as this arch villain. Yeah, they somehow hypnotized themselves with it. We still have the same mood in Europe. I mean, if you look at the newspapers, even military experts, so-called military experts, they know exactly in the year 2028, Putin will attack Europe. They probably know the exact time and the exact day. They're totally immersed, totally embedded in this kind of thinking. Where does it come from? I mean, you had it in the United States. Donald Trump does not absolutely share it, but the old administration had it. Where does it come from? Is it just like, how do you say, they want to distract from their own problems? They need this devil in order to be saints? What's behind it?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. To some extent, it distracts people from what's happening at home. There's no question about that. It also helps to justify greater control over the society. If you can persuade everyone that they're under threat, it becomes much easier to suppress free speech, to suppress the individual rights of citizens in order to push them in the direction you want them to go. You know, in the United States, it is falling apart. People here no longer really believe what comes through the mainstream media. They don't really believe what the government says. We always sort of had a healthy mentality in the United States regarding government. It was always quite small and inconspicuous, and so we didn't pay too much attention to it. I recall I visited Sweden, I think, for the first time in 1978. I went there for a week, and I remember getting into the car, and the Swedish family that was showing me around Stockholm noticed that I was in the back seat, but I didn't put on my seatbelt. And they turned around and said, well, you must put on your seatbelt. I said, why? They said, well, the state has made a study and determined that it is good for you to wear the seatbelt. As a typical American, I said, well, the hell with the state. I don't give a damn what the state says. I don't want to wear one in the back seat. Of course, these poor people, you know, their whole world began to come apart and shatter. But I was expressing a very traditional American attitude towards the state. I probably would have just put the seatbelt on, but when they said the state made a study and decided it's good for you, that automatically alienated me, and I was ready to pick up my weapon and march to Concord Bridge and fight the British. You know, that's something we always disliked. I think I see more of that coming back in the United States. I wish there was more of that in Germany and France and elsewhere in Great Britain.
More skepticism towards the establishment, towards the state. And let's talk for a moment still about Vladimir Putin. I speak here from a strictly Swiss perspective. We are a very small country. We have defended ourselves in many wars, but that's a long time ago. We have also neglected totally our army. It's a shame. They start to rebuild it. But still, I mean, if we look at a country like Russia, and you know, I'm not an anti-Putin warmonger or something. I don't know. I'm not this ideologue of confrontation. But still, I would say Putin, deep in his heart, in his ultimate dreams, he wishes to rebuild the Soviet Union. I think, as a leader of this nation, of the Russians, I mean, they have lost so many countries. They have lost their territory after the Second World War. I mean, after they lost the Cold War. Somewhere deep down, the Russians have this, I don't know, this expansionist urge. Otherwise, they would not have a country over 12 time zones. So there is some rationality behind certain fears vis-a-vis Russia. I mean, you see it in Poland. Of course, it's very strong. It probably goes too far from my point of view. But still, I mean, there is a rational skepticism about Russia. What would you say to these people also in the Baltic states who would contradict you and say, well, you're underestimating Russia. This is typically American. You have been behind the ocean, but we have lived under them. We have lived in their vicinity, and I tell you, never trust the Russians. What do you say to these people?
I think I would urge them to take note of the fact that Vladimir Putin is an avid reader of Solzhenitsyn's works. By the way, so am I. I'm a great admirer of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And the points that he made over and over and over again were that Russia needs to get out of these places where the people are not Russian. In other words, if they're not Slavs and Orthodox Christians, why are we there? It's more trouble than it's worth. It's a catalyst for conflict. And he viewed Ukraine as a country that was effectively in the Slavic Orthodox family. Now, Putin is no fool. He knows the history very, very well. And he knows that once you cross the Dnieper River, that the western part of Ukraine, I'm talking about north of Odessa, north of the Black Sea, has historically been more Polish and Lithuanian in terms of its government and influence than even German or Swedish than it has Russian. And so he's not interested in ruling the West Ukrainians under any circumstances. He just doesn't want them to come back as an existential threat to Russia. So I don't think that it's what you've said is a very commonplace feeling. You know, the Russians are at it again, but I don't think they are. The other thing is that if you look at the map, you talked about 12 time zones. He has an enormous problem in eastern Siberia. Once you pass through the Urals and you move into eastern Siberia, there aren't very many Russians there. And that's the failure of many, many centuries both of the czars and their Soviet successors to populate those areas, because it's not an easy place to live. We know that. And of course, in the back of his mind, he worries about who else may be interested in it. And he knows from history that the people most interested in that area are the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1920, when the Japanese joined the Western Intervention Force against the Bolsheviks, the Japanese military commander was told that he could go as far as Lake Baikal. Now look at the map. Look at where Lake Baikal is. Look at the tremendous amount of territory that encompasses. And you say, well, why would the Japanese say that? Well, from their standpoint, the original Mongolian race, of which they are a part, along with the Koreans and the Manchus, all come from Lake Baikal, from the eastern side. And they look at that eastern Siberia as rich in resources that they, as Japanese, could exploit very effectively. I think that continues to be in his mind, which is one of the reasons he has not been willing to turn over the islands and the Kurils that the Japanese would like to have, because I think he is suspicious that the Japanese would like to come back. Remember, the Japanese, they moved into Korea and Manchuria. They occupied those areas because historically they had much in common with the people living there, racially, linguistically, and so forth. I think he's more worried about that, frankly, than he has any concerns in the West. Mm-hmm. I think he's perfectly willing to let the bygones be bygones and let the rest of Europeans have whatever they want. I don't think he wants anything to do with it. He just wants to do business.
Well, what is totally striking for me, I mean, if you look at the Cold War, you're much more an expert of that than I am. But I remember, I mean, I was very young at the time. There you had really great systemic differences between the United States, the Western European countries, and Russia, which was a total dictatorship. Even if you compare it, of course, with China under Mao, it's amazing. Russia and China are, of course, not democracy. They're democracies, they're autocratic states, some Russia with some democratic elements. But the general trend in history, it seems to me, is that these systems, these civilizations, they come closer together. The similarities grow bigger and bigger, and there are still differences, but these differences are minor or smaller compared to the Cold War time. But at the moment, especially in Europe, not in the United States, the people seem to think, especially the politicians, that it's even worse. And it's even it's almost a crime to sit at the same table as with Putin. What do you think? I mean, do you share this theory that these differences between China, Russia, the United States and Europe somehow are diminishing? Or is this a naive view of these current historical trends?
Well, different nations or civilizations, as you point out, have different models of development. And if you look at Friedrich List and his concepts for state development and state economic management, they are much more favorably received in Japan and Korea and Russia than they are in the West.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean there's something wrong with those people. I mean, Friedrich List took as his model Prussia, because Prussia had to develop and become a powerful state without very much in the way of natural resources or natural defenses. And I think that's an appealing model in those areas. Now, the Chinese are a little different, because China contains at least four or five regions equal in size and population to the United States. So they have a provincial model, if you will, as opposed to a centrally guided unitary model.
Mm-hmm.
I think increasingly people will move away from the notion that liberal democracy, as we claim to practice it, and there are a lot of people like me who look at what we call liberal democracy and aren't very pleased by it because we don't think it's what we say it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the Declaration of Independence, you look at the Constitution. The Constitution is about how you govern yourself. But what is most important? What is most important to us is the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is critical.
Mm.
I would urge every European to look at our Bill of Rights. Mm. Now, how you guarantee those rights is government. The way you govern is going to change over time. We're still living with a constitution designed in 1789 in 2025. That's ridiculous. It doesn't fit any longer. But if you say in the United States, oh, well, we need to rethink how we govern ourselves, everyone's, oh, no, this is perfect. We live in utopia. No, it's not utopia. Change is inevitable. We need to adapt. But that Bill of Rights, which describes us as human beings, what we as human beings deserve and should have, that's vital and essential. How you govern is much less important than that. Now, at the same time, we have to understand that what we consider to be important to us in terms of human rights and what the average Chinese thinks are very different.
Mm-hmm.
That's culture. You know, what are we going to do? Kill each other over the fact that different civilizations take a different view of these things? Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
I mean, how many hundreds of billions of dollars in lives did we squander in Southeast Asia on Vietnam in an effort to turn Vietnam into a liberal democracy? It's a complete waste of time. Today, we have good relations with Vietnam. And by the way, Vietnam is far more authoritarian than China or Korea or Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever brings it up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. It doesn't make any difference because we're doing business. We can cope with each other. We can reach middle ground to understand each other and simply accept the fact that not everyone has to live in a society that resembles our own. And I think this sort of narcissism in the West has got to go away.
What is at the bottom, at the heart of Trump's foreign policy in your eyes? I mean, we see there is a rapprochement with Russia, the attempt to make peace. But what's the motivation behind it? Do you think that Trump will have the same pragmatic approach towards China, or is the ultimate goal to push the Russians a bit on the side of the Americans to go after the Chinese? What's your take on that?
Well, you have a group of people in Washington who fancy themselves as great strategists. And so they think they're playing with states and peoples and civilizations, and that they can somehow or another modify relations to drive a wedge between China and Russia. Well, that's absurd. You know, from the standpoint of Moscow and the standpoint of Beijing, why would these two people ever go to war? There's no interest in going to war. You know, they say, well, the Chinese want to control Central Asia. No, they don't. They just want to make sure Genghis Khan doesn't come back. Mm-hmm. That's a different matter. And the Russians agree with them. They both agree that we don't want a power in Central Asia that could resemble what the Mongolian armies were. But other than that, the interest is purely in business. And they have a very symbiotic relationship. The Chinese have the largest manufacturing base in the world, probably the largest that has ever existed. I would argue that China is in a developmental phase similar to what we were during and immediately after World War II. Our industrial base grew dramatically in response to the Second World War. Their base is growing because the response is to the world. What China makes, the world will buy. And they know that. And the Russians have the resources. They have much know-how and knowledge and technology. The mix of these things are important to China. The Chinese, in turn, can produce things on a scale that Russia cannot. And they need those resources. I don't see any evidence for any problem there. I don't see why that should threaten us. I don't think President Trump sees China in that sense as a threat. His argument has always been, we don't want to go to war with China. We want to do business with China, but that business has to occur on a more level playing field. In other words,
does
it has to be mutually
beneficial.
Do you think
that? Do you think that the Chinese are doing unfair business with the United States?
I think the Chinese will do anything, anytime, anywhere, with anybody that they can get away with when it comes to business. Let's be frank. That's the Chinese approach. If you're stupid, you leave your money on the table, the Chinese will come in and take it.
It's probably, you know, everybody's approach.
Well, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, what I used to go to South Korea and Japan on business. And what they would just shake their heads and say, why are you Americans so stupid? Of course, I'd say, well, I don't know. You tell me. He said, well, do you see any Chinese in our laboratories? Do you see Chinese that have access in our universities to technology? I said, well, I guess not. He said, of course not. If you allow them in, they're going to steal. They've been doing this for 2,000 years. The whole diaspora in Asia existed to send whatever was useful and good back to the homeland, back to China. This is not a new development. They know that. Right now, China and South Korea and Japan, on an economic level, are remarkably integrated. People don't understand that. They really are. Now, politically, they have differences. But the economic integration has helped promote political stability in Asia. Yeah. No one in Asia wants a war. If you look at the enormous time, money, and resources the Chinese have invested to build up China, to build these magnificent cities, airports, infrastructure, why would they want to put all of that at risk in a war? They don't. Japan has already been to China in a war, sees no good reason to go back. Right. That was a dumb idea. A very famous Japanese general, after he'd been in China for 6 months in 1937, he said, the only thing in China are Chinese. Why are we here? In other words, this is a disaster. I think the Asians understand that. South Korea is very valuable to China and Japan. North Korea is not.
Mm.
It's a dead end. It's a basket case. It survives on welfare from Russia, primarily. And they're very responsive to Russia for that reason. But they're scheduled for extinction. Chinese know that. If we left the peninsula, the Chinese would begin working to merge North with South under South Korean leadership. We don't get that. We don't understand that.
And there will Taiwan, be no war. And what do you think about Taiwan? This is, I mean, I've spoken to many people in Trump's environment, people, you know, in his former government, Robert Lighthizer, the trade secretary at the time, or you talk to people like Peter Thiel and others, and they're very negative on China. They really, you think, I might not misunderstand it, but I had the impression they think China really is the enemy of the United States. Are these strong voices in the U.S., or is this kind of just, you know, not relevant?
I think there are voices like that. But I've also begun to suspect that this is part of the same group that has said, well, we made a mistake in Ukraine. Russia's not that important. It's not really a threat to us. It's not an economic superpower. Mm. China's the real threat. We ought to all go back and focus on China. In other words, it's the search for the boogeyman again.
Yeah.
You know, China is like, there's this old expression in English, a ship is a fool to fight a fort. In other words, if a ship sails close to the coast and tries to take on a coastal fort, it's going to lose to the coastal fort.
Yeah.
China is the largest coastal fortress in the world.
Mm.
Anybody who attacks it is a fool.
Yeah.
You're going to waste your time, your money, resources, and accomplish nothing. China is, its very size and structured is a defense against any foreign attack.
Yeah, okay.
Nobody wants to accept the fact that China, which for most of the last 2,000 years has probably been the richest country in the world, is now rich again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they can see that as a threat, or they can see it as somebody that you do business with. I think Donald Trump sees it as a business partner. He doesn't see it as a military threat. He has said that repeatedly. We're not going to go to war with China. But I had dinner with Peter Thiel, and I listened to him, and I thought he was completely bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I pushed, you know, what is it about China? I got this, well, I have a feeling. I just don't feel good about it. It's not a good place. I don't like it. Come on, give me a break. You know, the other thing is with Taiwan. Taiwan is 6,000 miles from the United States. It's 100 miles from China. Why are we involved in Taiwan? That is the silliest notion in the world. It's the dumbest idea I can think of. Yeah. And that's another fight you can lose because it's too far away. Doesn't make sense. Everyone goes back in the United States, sadly, to the Second World War. And they think, well, look what we did in World War II. We can do that again. Those are unique circumstances, and no, we cannot do that again. And that was President Eisenhower's conclusion at the end of the war. And when he became president, he said, we can never do that again. We should never do that again. We don't want to ever do that again. Mm-hmm. I think President Trump is very similar in his thinking. The problems for President Trump are not necessarily with China from a military standpoint. He wants to look at ways to interact commercially that makes sense for us. And again, you know, they talk about the fentanyl, the components, the chemical components of fentanyl. Well, China ships them into San Francisco. They're loaded onto trains. They go south into Mexico. The drug cartels take the components, mix them up, becomes fentanyl. They sell the drugs into the United States and kill 120,000 Americans every year. Now, is the way to stop that a war on China? No, of course not. But that means that you have a border you have to defend. Yeah. You have to keep people out. You have to keep drugs out. And it's not just a border. We have coastal waters. The same thing is true. People in the United States are beginning to understand that the fight we need to win is here, nowhere else.
Yeah.
I think Europeans are beginning to sense that they, too, have to defend their borders. They haven't done it, and they're in a lot of trouble as a result.
I mean, that's a big question. I will just address it in shortly. But one thing here, Greenland. I mean, this is now of some strategic interest. I mean, President Trump has said, well, we might buy it, we might take it. Well, what do you think about this? Is that just talk? Is that just whatever, you know, headline stuff? Or is there a grain of truth in it?
Since 1945, Greenland, Norway, Canada have all been part of our defense periphery. In other words, when you look at our air and missile power, our naval power, we have maintained a presence in those northern regions ever since the end of the Second World War. Why do we need to build a new military base on Greenland? We've already got one. What is this all about? And I've asked that repeatedly to some people on the inside. Denmark and the United States have had wonderful relations for decades. All of a sudden now, we're angering Denmark over Greenland. It makes no sense. Now, perhaps somebody has told President Trump that the Norwegians just found the largest deposit of rare earths in Europe, just offshore in northern Norway. So perhaps someone is telling him there is a large deposit just offshore in Greenland. I don't know. But the point is, if that's the case, we don't need to invade the place to get to it. And we have good relations with the Danes. So we could sit down and make arrangements and we'll all be successful and wealthy as a result. Yeah. So to put it bluntly, I think all of this bellicosity is stupid and unnecessary.
Yeah.
This is another facet of Trump's personality. I think President Trump believes, and this may be based on his experience in business, I don't know, but I do think he believes that threats work. I do not. Threats can be useful sometimes, but not all the time.
Yeah.
We are threatening too many people too frequently. It needs to stop.
NATO. This is also a big concern now in Europe that the United States might leave NATO. I mean, NATO, to me, honestly, it seems a bit like an anachronism. I mean, it was founded in the Cold War. It seems to me like a military alliance with no clear mission, with a lot of failures. What's the future of NATO? What should the future of NATO be? Have you some thoughts about this?
Well, in November 1997, when I was first assigned to Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe in Mons, and I walked into what is called the Joint Operations Center, whose focus at the time was on the Balkans. Eventually it expanded, but it was essentially Bosnia-Herzegovina, then ultimately expanded to include Kosovo. And I looked around and I said to several German, Dutch, Danish, Italian officers, I said, what's NATO's mission? There's no threat from Russia. And no one at the time thought there was any threat from Russia. They said, well, in the absence of the Soviet Union, everyone in Europe has only one natural enemy. I said, really? What's that? They said, France. So the only thing they could agree on is that they all disliked the French. Well, you know, I thought NATO was a success in 1992, 93, 94, and the success should have ended NATO. In other words, we've been a success. Now it's time for the Europeans to sort out their future. We Americans can go home. And of course, you'll recollect that at the time you had people on the Hill saying, well, if NATO is not out of area doing other things with us, then NATO is out of business. And at the time I thought, well, then I think NATO should be out of business. Why should all the Europeans commit their military forces to imperial adventures in the Middle East, Africa, or Asia under our leadership? But I held the minority opinion, and I was told to shut up and color. So I spent the next two and a half years at NATO headquarters, and I concluded there was no reason for it to exist and it should go away. Unfortunately, it was instrumentalized into some sort of disastrous instrument of international power and terror. It didn't need to be that way.
So you would argue today still, NATO mission accomplished, we can get rid of it and we should build a new structure, probably including Russia, especially in Europe. I mean, this would be, in my view, the urgency, you know, to build some kind of security infrastructure. Is there an utopia where we can say there is a common security architecture with Russia, Europe, the United States, and even China, or is this naive thinking?
No, I mean, you're recognizing something that I think has to be recognized more widely. We all live on the planet together. This is not the 19th century. It's not the mid-20th century. We live in a different world today. We are a planetary civilization, if you will. There are different versions of us, but we are a planetary society. And I think you're right. And the other thing is that you can't build security anywhere in Central East Europe without Russian participation. It's simply impossible. That's the way it is. Yeah. The Germans know that. They understand that. They were the first to figure this out. And they've lost their minds in recent years. They need to get back on board with reality. And the Poles the same way. I think in Europe, we deal with these legacy structures that no longer exist. If you go to Lithuania, they talk about the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and why it should be resurrected. And if you go to Germany, you know, you'll find people that talk about the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. Okay, all of those things existed. They all had a reason for existence at the time, and they actually had a positive impact in most cases. But we don't live in that world anymore. We're in a planetary mode now. And so I think you're absolutely right. Now, for the last 25 years, in numerous op-eds and in books that I've written, I have advocated for a European to be the supreme commander of the armed forces of NATO, not an American. Now, the Europeans don't want that, or at least they say they don't, because they don't want any European in charge. In other words, if you put a German four-star in charge, then that will upset the French or the Italians or somebody else. If you put a French four-star in charge, that will upset the British, the Danes, and somebody else. You know, I'm sorry, I don't have time to sort out your squabbles. Yeah. Europe's going to have to sort this out. It may be that you don't get a European-wide security zone. It may be that you get what I would call a Nordic plus zone with the three Baltic states, the Scandinavia, and Germany, as an example. Again, you've got to go back to culture. You know, one of the things that everybody talks about how terrible it was under the Russians. Well, I'm not here to defend the Russians, certainly not the Soviets, but when Peter the Great took over the Baltic states, the Baltic littoral, which at the time was called Kurland, it had been Swedish, but the aristocracy was always German. When he took it over, he after the Treaty of Narva and so forth, he said, listen, I don't want to change a thing. You have a very successful society, good business models. I'm going to incorporate you into my table of ranks. And then, of course, I want you to pay me taxes. But I'm not changing anything. Now, that doesn't sound terribly oppressive to me. Mm-hmm. Now, subsequent czars behave differently, that's to be sure. But I think today, Putin understands there's no reason for any Russian administration in Finland, Lithuania, Latvia, or Estonia. He doesn't want it. It's a burden on an asset. That was Solzhenitsyn's argument. He believes Solzhenitsyn, so do I. So I think that's all has got to go away. But how Europe shapes up, because clearly Italy, Spain, Portugal, France to some extent, Greece, they have a different focus from everyone in Berlin or Helsinki or Stockholm. That's natural. You know, so everybody doesn't have to be inside the next construct. But that's for Europeans to sort out.
Yeah, that would be an interesting debate. At the moment, there is still a lot of confusion. We started with the war in Ukraine. Let's switch back to end our conversation. I mean, how close are we really at for peace? I see two dangers. First, Zelensky, he seems to be eager still to expand this war. I've just read there was a new front somewhere in the northern part somewhere. They attack, they're on attack mode, but still the Russians are winning. Zelensky, but still seems to, he wants to expand it. Then the Europeans, they have now some rhetoric saying, well, we have to resist the Americans, we have to sort this out our way. But it's very confusing also, because Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, he added then, well, of course, we don't want to act without the Americans. Well, in this confusion of different voices, where do we stand? How close is a peace, and how could it look like?
I think the key to everything is an American decision to leave Ukraine, to suspend the aid and get out. Now, why do I say that? For the very reason that you cited. Starmer has said, we really don't want to act without the Americans. What he really meant was, we can't act without the Americans. The Europeans cannot act without the American military establishment. They don't have the command and control structures. They don't have the satellite arrays. They don't have the logistical support base. They can't do it without us. That should be made very clear now by President Trump. You're right. You can't. We're out. That's number one. Once that happens, I think you could convene a discussion between Moscow and the countries that border Russia and Ukraine. And I think that's where it has to be. I would include Germany because of its long-term strategic interests in the area. But I think that you have to look at Romania, Moldova, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, Germany, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Finland. They need to sit down, and an agreement needs to be reached that ends the conflict with new boundaries. And I think that can happen. But as long as we sustain the military assistance to Ukraine, Zelensky will spit in our face. I mean, frankly speaking, if you are President Trump, what has this man done to you? He has spit in your face. He spits in your face routinely. I was sent a video this morning from a friend over in Europe that showed the Ukrainians burning American flags and showed the faces of Trump and other people in the United States on poles, and they were burned. All right, fine. Leave. Get out. Ukraine was never what people said it was. It's never been this glorious liberal democracy as a bastion against the evil Russians. Far from it. How many times have we talked about all these Nazi symbols?
Yeah.
All the Germans were horrified by that. We should have been horrified by it. I'm not saying that that's a justification for what the Russians have done. That's different. They have an existential threat there. We've talked about that. What I'm simply saying is, this is not something we should support. We now admit that 50% of all the cash that we've delivered, and probably 50% of most of the aid in terms of equipment has all been pilfered and sold on the black market. We have drug cartels in Mexico walking around with Javelin missile systems that were acquired from Ukraine. What are we doing? This is insane. All we're doing is feeding international terrorism, international lawlessness, and corruption. It needs to stop.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. The glorification of Zelensky is somehow the other side of the demonization of Vladimir Putin. I will end this with an optimistic remark. I mean, in our conversations we had, we always had to talk about all these terrible misunderstandings and these political errors, strategic errors, the war in Ukraine, all these things. We didn't touch upon the war in the Middle East. It's a too depressing topic for me. My nerves are too weak for that. So we have to spare that for another time. But I think, speaking to you now, even if there are still many problems, I would say we are entering a more positive phase now. For me, the age of confrontation seems to evolve into a new probable age of cooperation. I see political changes, especially in Europe. I see a European Union which puts itself into absurdity, digging the holes ever deeper they're already in. And I see that the consciousness of the people, the resistance against it, the people wake up and they do not follow this wrong policy. You have people like Viktor Orban, you have election results. Even if they try to push it down, even if they try to derail democracy in Romania, now they put a lot of pressure on President Vucic, who is not in line with these globalists, or how to call them. So I would make a more optimistic resume. I think we are entering a more pragmatic age of common sense again. Of course, this is exaggerated, but still I want to hear your opinion. Do you share?
Well, Roger, I have to wrap up because I've got to go into a meeting.
Just a very short summary.
But very shortly, I would say that until this globalist ruling class in Paris, London, and Berlin is removed from office, there will be no long-term stability or prosperity in Europe. They have dug Europe into a very deep hole. The Europeans need to get rid of them. If they do, then everything can be as you've described. But they're not going to get there with the people that are currently running affairs in Berlin, London, and Paris.
Colonel McGregor, Doug, thanks a lot for this in-depth analysis of world affairs. All the best to you, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Roger. All the best to you.